You're listening to EG's Connecting Tomorrow's Leaders podcast. I'm Rebecca Kent. Our guest in this episode is Morgan Garfield, who is one half of the duo that founded the retail venture Elandi in the midst of the 2007 and 2008 financial crisis. Elandi is a community shopping centre specialist, and its sites are home to a core band of retailers such as Boots, New Look and 99p stores. In this interview, Morgan tells us more about Elandi's strategy. However, more relevant to the theme of the Tomorrow's Leaders podcast, he tells us why he left the comfort and security of a job in banking and he ignored the wisdom of his family and his peers to do it his own way.
Nobody wants somebody to come into their office and tell them a worldview that is entirely contrary to their own, and one which, taken to its ultimate conclusion, probably means that the bank they work at doesn't exist anymore and their role doesn't exist.
He also tells us the kind of people he's looking to hire at Elandi.
We look to bring in people who are young, keen, smart, and then to give them a career path to develop their own talents within Elandi. Interestingly, we've hired non-surveyors in a number of instances.
The things people say to him the most, but he hates hearing, and his advice for unleashing your inner entrepreneur. Got sitting across from me in the studio, someone who a colleague of mine described as quote unquote a really great dude. What are your thoughts on that? Is that an image you try to project?
Hi, it's Morgan Garfield from Elandi. I'm not sure about the cool dude status. I think being the wrong side of 40 probably eliminates me from that, and the fact that I couldn't develop dreadlocks if I wanted to.
And, well, you've already introduced yourself, so thank you very much. I was just going to say we're talking to Morgan Garfield, Managing Director of the retail property company Elandi. And I have a sidekick today in the form of Amber Rolt, who is EG's retail reporter. And you're going to bring primarily your wonderful retail insight, Amber, and your unsuppressed enthusiasm and youth.
Yes, well, I'll prompt some insight, but it will be coming from the Oracle, Mr. Garfield, here.
Okay, so I suppose your day started off quite interestingly this morning, Morgan. Do you just want to elaborate on what that was all about?
Yes, this morning we launched some research that we'd conducted in conjunction with Savills, where we'd sampled 8,000 shoppers across 25 of our shopping centres, from Cornwall in the south to Aberdeen in the north, Norfolk to Northern Ireland. And essentially, we'd ask them the pretty basic question as to where they were shopping, why, what for, how frequently did they come. All pretty obvious questions for shoppers. But what we were really trying to tease out was where people shop today and why. I think there's been an awful lot written and said about retail. Most of it seems to be generally negative. And what we were really trying to do is bring some insight and data and understanding, rather than an assumption that everybody shops as I do, which we tend to find is a great generalization. I think because everybody shops, they think they understand retail. And those of us who are fortunate to, you know, live and work in property are probably slightly better off than the average across the UK. And there is this assumption that one's shopping patterns, you know, are then projected out across the rest of the nation. And what this data had proven was that actually shopping patterns have become very polarized, but are actually quite entrenched, that people seek destination, high-end aspirational shopping, which is becoming an increasingly leisure pastime, but they achieve that by visiting destination shopping centers, which is an occasional visit, but simultaneously they fulfill their everyday needs-based shopping with high frequency, reasonably low value shopping trips to local shopping centres. And with Savills' help, we were able to look at how this shopping pattern, which you has sort of been coined into the phrase community shopping, has evolved and how retailers are taking advantage of that. So some of the data we thought was interesting was that 78% of our shoppers visit a community shopping centre on a weekly basis or more frequently, and 92% of shoppers come at least once a month. Now that corresponds with only about 60% of shoppers going to a destination shopping centre once every 6 months. So you immediately start to see that there's a differential in frequency. But then looking at what people buy in their local shopping trips and why they make these shopping trips, and 70% of people claim that their shopping trips are convenience driven, with most of them having a defined shopping purpose, and that translates into very high sales ratios per visit. So broadly 77% of people acquire a purchase if they visit a community shopping centre, with an average basket spend of £36. So you suddenly, this what is perceived as a convenience trip and it's just a loaf of bread starts stacking up into some quite significant expenditure figures.
I think that crucial understanding, actually, from a retailer's perspective, you know, if you can understand who is shopping where and why and how much they're spending, that's, you know, such valuable business information. I mean, what do you think we can do to be able to understand that better about the consumer base?
Ultimately, retailers are collecting vast amounts of data and haven't typically seen landlords as partners. Landlords are literally almost the enemy, in that they provide shops and they charge too much service charge and always want the rents to go up. We're very much keen to engage as partners with our retailers and collecting information that is helpful to them and meaningful to them, managing shopping centres in a manner that hopefully increases footfall, improves the environment, exacerbates dwell time. You know, our research showed very clearly that if you could increase dwell time, you increase expenditure. So all of those things are things we can meaningfully do to help retailers. And our capacity to do that and have more meaningful debate and engagement with our core clients, ultimately, which is what our retailers are, is all driven by our own understanding of the marketplace. And yeah, there's lots of landlords who are now making much more effort to do that across the retail space.
That relationship with, you know, between the property industry and its occupiers is something that's being monitored quite closely right across all sectors. And we should definitely elaborate on that in the course of this chat. But I think it's worth getting to know a little bit more about you. Morgan, what do you think?
I'm happy to try and be entertaining.
So we, as we have with all of our interview guests, have asked you to reveal a few interesting things about you that perhaps your colleagues and peers may not know. Shall we go into the first one?
I'm happy to.
All right. Do you remember the first one? Shall I give you
I think the first fact you asked me was where did Alandi derive from? And we're probably not unique in being the only property venture that was effectively born in a pub. The background was that Mark Robinson, my partner, and I had got to know each other as a client banker type relationship. I'd previously been a lending banker. And over a number of pints of Guinness in 2007, we came to a similar worldview that things were likely to hit a pretty hard stop. Mark had a very different skill set to mine. He is an active asset manager who has, you know, a long CV in retail. I was a numbers monkey who understood property from a spreadsheet perspective, or so I thought. And we concluded that amalgamating our skills would give us an opportunity, if we were right about the world coming to an end, that would allow us an opportunity to buy into a heavily distressed market. And through Mark's ability to speak property and my capacity to unpick debt structures, that would be a pretty good and powerful combination. And hopefully it served us pretty well for the best part of a decade now. So it all started over beer, basically.
How many pints in were you by that stage?
Oh, quite a few, I suspect, before we both broached the courage in 2007 to admit that we thought the world was a little crazy and that there would be a pretty market correction. But yeah, the interesting part of our journey in that respect was we set the business up in very early 2008, and immediately hit the road, as all new entrepreneurs do, and went to see as many people as we could. And we went in to see the Royal Bank of Scotland and a chap who I knew pretty well, who was their head of workout at the time. And I explained my thesis that the world was effectively going to stop abruptly and there would be, you know, a massive workout problem, and was almost patronizingly sent on my way, "Morgan, you've got this so wrong. We're six people in workout, and by the end of the year, we might be 12, but credit standards are so much higher than they ever were before." 6 months later, there were 350 people in GRG and at RBS, and yeah, it was a similar story across the piece, effectively.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. So was that a common reaction then when you told people about this crazy idea that you had?
Yeah, one of the things I found that nobody wants somebody to come into their office and tell them a worldview that is entirely contrary to their own, and one which, taken to its ultimate conclusion, probably means that the bank they work at doesn't exist anymore and their role doesn't exist. That said, we built some fantastic relationships at that point in time that have held us in good stead ever since, and we've worked with a number of those people that we got to know during that point in time. Not always at the organizations they were at when we got to know them, but we had a really good run buying distressed debt, buying bankrupt corporates. And a large part of that came from, I think, being brave enough to be out there and explain to people why we thought something was going to happen. And when things did happen, we were fortunate enough to be in the mix for opportunities that came off the back of that.
So would you do anything differently now? I mean, you obviously had some
Absolutely. Yeah, I left Deutsche Bank in very early 2008 to set up Alandi. I would have taken every penny that I had at that point of time, shorted Anglo-Irish stock, and I would be sitting on a big Caribbean island at this point in time. But yeah, in reality, the journey has been a hugely rewarding one. Has been actually part of the fun, I think, for people who have grown up in big corporates as I did. To go out on your own is a scary, exciting, empowering, nerve-wracking experience all at the same time. And the whole process is one that I thoroughly enjoyed. It's not to say it's necessarily been the most financially rewarding course, but it's certainly been a very satisfying process, building a team, recruiting 25 people as we've done at Alandi, going from being two guys who rented a desk in the corner of some friendly surveyors' offices through to building our own business, and now we manage about 1.2 billion of assets, has been a wonderful, wonderful journey.
Tell us about your first office.
Our first office, we were lucky, and again, came out around over beer. There's going to be a repeating thematic in this.
The beer theme is absolutely fine by me. And you, Amber, presumably you agree.
Well, yeah, I think it's a fairly common trodden path within the retail world.
We ended up talking to James Watson of Bryant Champion Long, as was now at Colliers, about our need for a very small, very cheap office. And there were spare desks in the corner of the Bryant Champion Long office that we said we'd take for 6 weeks and squatted out for the best part of 18 months. And we've gradually moved from home to home and grown ever since.
Your current digs are quite nice though, actually, aren't they?
We took the brave step in property terms of moving across St James's Park and going to Westminster, which a number of people, including a number of people in our organisation, questioned the wisdom of. But what we found is that we've got some really good space in a reasonably central location at a significantly more affordable price than Mayfair rents.
And it hasn't done the business any harm?
Not that we've seen so far.
Excellent. And so I understand when you told your mother you were starting up Alandi, she had some interesting words.
An
interesting response.
Indeed, I think when you tell your parents that you're leaving a successful corporate job to go and rent a desk in the corner of somebody else's office with one other guy, they probably quite justifiably question your wisdom.
They have little faith.
Indeed. But my mother was ever thoughtful, and about a fortnight after we'd started the business, I got a little letter in the post that had all of the completed application forms to do a teacher training course at Swansea University. So that was my fallback, apparently.
Have you thought about going back to that, maybe?
I think, deep down, I am a frustrated PE teacher, but with reasonably small kids, I now do seem to spend most of my weekends coaching football and coaching rugby, so that at least seems to be working out of my system.
Oh, best of both worlds then.
What's your favourite sort of pep talk for the kids on sports day? You must.
The kids on sports day is an easy pep talk. You tell them it's all about having fun and participating, and you hope like hell they're going to win.
Is that what you tell your colleagues then too?
I think we're very lucky at Landy. I genuinely don't have to spend an awful lot of time trying to inspire people. We're hugely lucky in that we've managed to pull together a team of people from very diverse backgrounds. Unlike most property companies, we're not middle-aged guys or from a very similar set of backgrounds. We've got lots of nationalities, lots of ethnicities, pretty much a 50-50 female-male makeup. And we've got one trait that pulls people together, and that's that people like making a difference to the communities in which we invest, and we talk very seriously about that. We've got two objectives. One is to create better places that actually mean something to the people who live there, and secondly is obviously to generate a financial return for our investors. But we very much believe that the two things go hand in glove. So it's not that you have to prioritize one over t'other. If we can genuinely create better environments for local people, create jobs for local people, create prosperity in local communities, then the financial side of the investment equation should look after itself. So we have, and this sounds probably very, I know, very gimmicky, but four mission statements within Elandi, which are etched up on walls, which the team developed themselves, and that's about community, integrity, expertise and empowerment, and it's about empowering people to build their own careers. And we're really lucky we've got a team of people who take that on board. And I give the occasional pep talk, but it's very rarely required.
So how old were you when you started Elandi, when you founded Elandi?
I was 31 when I set up Elandi.
And are you seeing I mean, certainly we are seeing a lot of entrepreneurship and innovation coming through from right across the property sector. And certainly, when you started Elandi, as you say, people had little faith. So you really sort of bit the bullet and went for it. How much of that are you seeing in young people now in the industry coming through?
I think there is a slight generational shift in regards to people's willingness to work outside of a conventional career. I don't think there are many people who leave school or university today who think they will take up one post and work at that company for the rest of their lives. It happens, but it's now pretty rare. Tech seems to have been empowering in terms of opportunities for people. You can now set up a business working from your back bedroom or working in collaboration with two or three other people, where the perception that you could do that was pretty challenging in days gone by, and the concept was you really had to learn a trade before you could go out and do something on your own. And I'm full of admiration for people who are entrepreneurial and take that risk. I benefited massively from working at big organizations. I think some of the best advice I was given in the early part of my career was do something you enjoy with people who are good at it, where you see a lot of deal flow. And certainly when I was at Rothschild's, which was where I started my career, that was very much the case. And we were taught to do things properly. But across a variety of transactions that just appeared on your desk day after day, that does give you a training that you can't replicate anywhere else, I think. But the likelihood that more people are entrepreneurial going forward, I think is a good thing. And some of that will be born of necessity. there are a number of agents who have gone out and set up their own businesses recently. The opportunity cost of staying in a stable job in a poor market is much lower than it is in a booming market, which is often the catalyst for somebody to go out and start something. They're giving it a go because they have to, or they feel that it would be a better outcome for them. And it's from that giving it a go mentality that, that great things evolve. So many of the leading entrepreneurs in this country dropped out of school, dropped out of university, didn't finish the courses they were doing, and yet have made phenomenal successes of it.
So how interested are you in trying to capture some of that spirit in, you know, in young people today and bring them into the fold at Alandi?
We're hugely keen to bring in young people and create proper career paths for them. I'm not a believer in hiring 5 graduates. We're not of the size that we would anyway, but we look to bring in people who are young, keen, smart, and then to give them a career path to develop their own talents within Alandi. Interestingly, we've hired non-surveyors in a number of instances.
Is that to do surveyor type roles?
Yeah, we have a young lady called Isabel Heese in our investment team who came in to us with a business consultancy and an architecture background. She had done a course at CAS. The skills we saw in Izzy were not around the fact she had written 15 investment papers and she'd sold 5 shopping centres. It was that she had the hunger and the mental aptitude and the willingness to apply herself to problems and to find logical solutions. And I think increasingly that's how the world is likely to look.
Do you think the property industry is looking at it like that though? Or?
Some of the smartest people I know in property are not surveyors. And some of the best surveyors have come up through unconventional routes. It's not that you have to have been and done all of the exams in a linear fashion, and I think that seems to apply in any number of different industries. When I speak to friends who work in different segments and different sectors, there isn't a set career route anymore. It's about intellect for sure. Good levels of education are essential, but it's not necessarily about having had to have served your time as it maybe was a few years ago. It's now increasingly about applying yourself, showing your personality, being able to communicate, which is essential, whether that's in written format, in interview format, in presentational format. Because every time you meet somebody, if you're trying to advance your career, it's a sales opportunity for you to build your personal brand.
What advice would you give to the 31-year-old Morgan ahead of setting up?
If I could speak to the younger me, I would have probably done it earlier. Not just because the market timing might have been helpful, although it would have.
Well, had you been thinking about it earlier, or was it just the timing?
I'd always had an aspiration that I would go and do my own thing at some point in time. I come from a family of farmers where I guess running your own business was part of the equation. But when was the right time ever going to come? And I think a lot of people probably go through their career thinking, I'd like to do my own thing, but there was never an appropriate point. And maybe that's the case for any number of different reasons. But I think there is an element of, once you have picked up a set of skills in a role for a certain period of time, how much more are you going to benefit from that role? And when is the right time for you to move on, as opposed to when the right time from the corporate perspective is for you to move on? Mm. So I might have gone and done it a little bit sooner. Would I have done it dramatically differently? I don't think I would have in hindsight.
Let's talk about if we had some youngsters who are very keen, who have their hearts set on working in the retail industry. What do you think they could and should really make themselves an expert at to shine?
I don't think anybody can be an expert in everything. So the correct balance is to have a broad understanding of everything but expertise in something. And it probably doesn't matter exactly what that expertise is, as long as you're really good at it. And the, but you have to understand where everybody fits into the value chain. And I think that probably applies in every industry, not just in retail or not just in property. If you understand where people make money, how they make money, where people fail and why they fail, and you've got that breadth of understanding, even if it's reasonably superficial, but you can also point to expertise in a particular field, then you have the opportunity to build your career and to move at different stages in that career. In our asset management team, we have guys who started in property management who became very good property managers and then were able to move or shift their strategy into asset management, for example. Equally, we have somebody in our investment team who started as a generalist valuation surveyor and has moved into the investment business. It's quite easy to get stuck in a silo that you maybe don't want to be in, but you don't ever get out of that silo by being rubbish at what you do. The way to be able to move sideways and ultimately upwards and onwards is to, if you are the star performer in a team, you have a much better chance of being picked to do something else than if you are obviously miserable and negative in that environment. People don't typically go out their way to say, well, you're miserable and negative, how can we make you happier?
You alluded earlier to the fact that everyone shops and therefore everyone thinks they're an expert in retail. Is that something you sort of have to deal with?
I think it's a fact, in the same way that all of us can have a conversation about the residential market. I have no specific expertise in residential market, but I've rented a house, I bought a house. That's de facto, I know something about residential property. And any expert in residential, I'm sure, would be holding their hands. You know nothing.
Have you ever tried to impart your residential knowledge onto someone?
I really try to avoid conversations about house prices.
I think house prices, they're kind of expensive these days, right? Yeah.
The same is true of shopping. The most frustrating comment I have in almost any meeting is when somebody says, that's not how I shop, or that's not how my wife shops.
Well, surely they're all doing it on the internet.
Lo and behold, that is almost always the answer. And explaining to would-be Italian investor dressed head to toe in Hermes how you and why people shop in Wilkinson's or Poundland is a challenging course of events. But so many people view the world through their own prisms. And as I said earlier, we're generally a pretty lucky bunch in real estate in terms of our positions. And people forget that the average wage in the UK is £27,000. And when 50% of that goes on housing and utility bills, you're not left with an awful lot of disposable income. And people shop very differently to the 40-year-old man with three kids in private school who lives somewhere in southwest London whose wife is at home every day. And saying to people, I've worked at subtly trying to say to people, you are not typical, you are not average. You have to do it subtly. Nobody wants to be told you don't understand. But we are always guilty, I think, of occasionally seeing the world through our own prism rather than through what other people see.
I mean, all we hear about retail is how disruptive it's being, by online shopping. You must be hearing it over and over again.
Absolutely. And I'd hate to be mistaken for being a denialist. We don't pretend that retail doesn't have a whole series of disruptive influences, headwinds. But we still think within that environment, there is a role for a certain type of shopping. And arguably, our conviction to that gets stronger rather than weaker. That the fact other people don't necessarily see the same investment case that we see, the fact we are forever developing our scale and our expertise and our relationships with retailers and our understanding as to how we pull the value levers within these shopping centres, we're increasingly committed to the concept that community shopping centres have a a very sustainable role to play. And as the sector becomes more out of favour, prices fall, and that arguably creates an even stronger investment opportunity.
So what does the future hold for community shopping centres in that space? And what, you know, what are you planning for? What's the strategy? And what will support that vision?
The Elandi objective is pretty straightforward. Going back to the core values we have is to be as good as we feasibly can be in what we do, to understand all of the value levers we can pull, and to do that to ensure that the communities that we're interested in looking after their shopping centres get the best possible outcomes. How that evolves in a market presence situation is to a certain extent influenced by the capital markets and the willingness of investors to buy, or the aspiration of investors to sell. One of the things we feel quite strongly about is that these assets fit very strongly with a longer term investment base. Largely, the active community of shopping centre investors has been time dated, generally private equity funds who are always going to be cyclical holders of these assets. As their funds come to maturity, they will necessarily become sellers. The opportunity is one to build a truly income-based model where you are investing long-term capital that can pay a sustainable long-term dividend yield. And we're spending quite a lot of time investigating and exploring how we can best fit the product, which is the real estate, to the financial returns required of what we consider possibly to be the optimal group of equity investors. And that's something that is interesting, challenging, especially given current attitudes towards the UK specifically and UK retail as well. But one of the challenges that's keeping me mentally stimulated, at least at the moment.
Well, have you thought about picking up the phone to local council in some of those situations? They've been certainly digging into their pockets a bit recently.
We've just completed a sale of a shopping centre in Bootle to Sefton Council, which has been an interesting experience. We've been retained to assist Sefton in managing the asset. That, in my mind, is a clever piece of strategic investment from the council. Sefton have a master plan for Bootle, which is one of two big towns in the council, and the shopping centre, which is a big 19th century shopping centre, sat at the heart of that. So in order for them to be able to really control their own destiny, buying the shopping centre really gave them a lot more strategic control over their master plan, while simultaneously it's going to generate them a healthy cash yield that supplements their ever dwindling central government budget, or central government funded budget. So in that respect, I think that is wise, it's clever, and really that's government investing in what I would consider to be local infrastructure. I think you look at some of the other council purchases that have happened, specifically where you've got councils buying out of their jurisdiction and they are buying financial investments. That is investment speculation, frankly. And it may have been forced upon them by their cuts, but I think if those deals go wrong, it's going to be quite difficult for some of the executives in the council to justify why that was a wise investment of ultimately what is, albeit it's borrowed capital, it's underwritten by the taxpayers of that jurisdiction. And I think they will be the ones that will get more scrutiny. But the Sefton style investment, if we call it that, I think is something that with correct advice and oversight is a positive and proactive step to really try and regenerate some of the UK's town centres.
Is that something that you will try to encourage, but what sort of involvement will you have in perhaps getting other local authorities to follow that?
We've spoken to an awful lot of local authorities, as I'm sure have many advisors and asset managers like ourselves. We've found that they actually drive their own bus, that somebody advocating this is what you should do, in our experience, hasn't led to a change of heart. That most of these councils are actually making very proactive investments are run by strong leaders, strong politicians, who are germinating their own ideas rather than being led by investment agents or asset managers to making decisions, which is correctly how it should be.
Okay, tell us about the relationship between retailers and landlords, how that's changing and how it should change, you think.
When I came into retail from a banking perspective, I was totally new to retail and I couldn't get my head around why there wasn't a effective supplier-client relationship. I have friends who work in the retail chain and if you are a supplier to Tesco's or to Waitrose, or you talk to them every day and you understand their volumes and you understand their pricing pressures and you share in that. You share the pain, you share the upside. The landlords are effectively yet another supplier, but yet I think probably by dint of 25-year leases and the history of the Landlord and Tenant Act, didn't feel the need to engage in that process at all. It was almost a gift to retailers that they would be deemed acceptable to exist in your shopping centre. Possibly it's because the boot has now been on the other foot and it's increasingly the gift of retailers to remain in a tenant in your scheme. I mean, there has been a shift towards a more collaborative working regime, and we very much champion that and want to work closely with our retailers and understand their troubles and their challenges and hopefully help them in dealing with it. And hopefully on the flip side, as the good times return, maybe we'll participate in the upside. That said, there still remains a significant element of distrust and an unwillingness to be very open around those arrangements. And I think some of that is historical, but some of it is also a feeling that landlords don't really contribute that much to their retail journey. And until landlords invest properly in that, and actually part of it is the Landlord and Tenant Act, the concept of an upwards-only rent review disincentivizes people from sharing information and it potentially being used against them in the future. But there are increasingly close relationships with retailers, and we certainly have core retailers across our portfolio that we talk to on a frequent basis. We're able to use that better understanding to hopefully get better outcomes across the portfolio, and their outcomes that work for us and work for the retailers.
Do you have any advice for other landlords that are looking to improve the relationship with their retail tenants? Because I think, particularly, I think out of all sectors, I think of retail, it's one of the most important. I think particularly over the last 18 months, just the recurrence of CVAs, all of that, presumably in those situations, if you've got an existing dialogue going with your retailers or your tenants, then that can helpfully make some of those situations easier.
You would hope that would be the case, of course. I'm not sure we're in any position to be doling out advice to other landlords, but we wouldn't think we certainly wouldn't want to think of ourselves in doing that. But I don't think there's any magic to it. Mm. The honest answer is, it's like building a relationship with anybody else. If you enter into discussions, get to know people, and it is all about people as much about corporates, you invest the time and the effort to get to know people, and then as those relationships develop, you can start to gain mutual benefit from it. But I don't think there's any magic.
You spoke about collaboration a little bit there. Where do you think collaboration can be done better?
There's probably always opportunity to collaborate better. The industry is very good at collaborating socially. We're probably one of the most fun, outward-going industries you could possibly wish to work in. But I'm not sure we share best practice. I'm not sure we necessarily share systemic issues and concerns and work together on those. And whether and there are people who work very hard in the background, whether that's the BPF or the various the APB and the various groups that cover different segments of the market. But I think we still generally operate as a series of fiefdoms and individual enterprises. And
why is that?
I'm not quite sure what the reason is. Whether people don't believe that collective action will generate results, and I can understand where that cynicism comes from, or whether it's just not a priority. But there are undoubtedly groups who can work together for better outcomes, and we talk a lot to our peers. We don't see the shopping centre asset management universe as being a them and us. We regularly have sessions with other operators where we talk about what we're doing, how we can do things better, and we all benefit from that process.
You spoke about the social aspect of the industry. I know, Amber, you've been to a few great parties.
A few, yeah, something like that.
What sort of a networker are you? How would you describe yourself as a networker?
I worked very hard at it in the earlier parts of my career, and I've probably now become a little lazy, but...
Oh, I think I beg to differ, I think.
I guess I'm lucky. I'm one of those people, if I walk into a room full of people, that I want to talk to everybody. The people I've never met before are potentially the most interesting. Okay, they could be in the corner for a reason, but you take your chances and you speak to strangers, and generally you aren't disappointed by the outcomes. But and if you are a naturally sociable person, that makes life easy. I think the challenge is, if you are not that natural sociable person, the industry does push you in that direction, and you are expected to develop your network and to win clients and win opportunities. And I'm sure for some people that's a challenge, but the positive mental attitude, you can do it. But you do have to be wary of too many drinks at the end of the day.
So what's, perhaps give us an opening question you might ask to someone in a networking space that you've never seen before. Fairly curious to know about.
Oh, I would be terrible at chatter blinds. It would be something very mediocre. Like, so how do you know these people, or how do you fit into this event?
Morgan, you can do better than that.
I'm sure I could, but I've lived on bad chat for a long time.
All right, well, it hasn't done you too much harm, clearly. Do you remember your first interview experience?
Funnily enough, I remember all the ones that went really badly.
Oh, go on. We can learn more from
I think you can learn. I think you learn the most from the ones that go badly than you do for the ones that go well, it seems.
I remember being asked to, if I could size the global satellite market at some management consultancy shop, and realising at that point in time that I was really out of my depth.
Well, what was the answer?
Oh, I think the answer was you were supposed to work through a series of back of the fag packet calculations that if a satellite was worth £1 million and there were maybe 100 million satellites and et cetera, et cetera. And I remember 27 interviews and no job offer at Goldman's as well, which was...
What gave me the impression you were supposed to know about this satellite stuff?
I think the whole idea was you could think outside the box, which evidently I couldn't.
I think, thinking outside the box, that's always a difficult interview.
My only interview tip would... we all elaborate on our CVs, we all elaborate in interviews, just don't say something that's so blatantly untrue that you can't back it up with the next line.
How do you interview people? What's the process?
My interview style is dire. I end up talking more than they do, and basically as long as they let me talk for 45 minutes, they're probably going to be fine. In all seriousness, I'm just looking to find some personality. You're probably capable of doing the job if you're in the interview, in most instances. You've got into the role, the opportunity, because your CV is good enough or you have the track record. It's then about showing your individuality and creating some sort of vibe between you and the interviewer that you would fit into that environment and you would be a good team member. Personally, I've always felt that interviews are a two-way process. If one side loves the other one and it doesn't work in reverse, then it probably isn't the right fit and the chemistry isn't there. So I'm a big believer in interviews being a two-way street, and it's got to work for both sides. And I know when you're junior in the profession, that's hard, but I think it applies all the more in some respects, because especially if you're going to be part of a big team, you've got to feel that you fit in. And one of my tips would be, if you're offered a job, to ask to meet other colleagues, especially people of your grade, ask to go for a coffee or a drink and find out what it's really like under the bonnet, and you not sign up for something that you've got only a superficial understanding of.
Ask what the boss is like. Really, are you right?
and people generally, people will probably give you a straight answer.
What would they say about you?
Oh, I dread to think what they'd say about me.
he's a cool dude.
he's a great dude. Perhaps you could just give us a bit of an insight into how you do a great deal. Who do you talk to? Where do you find the investors? Where do you find the money?
I guess every great deal starts with an idea. So intrinsically, if you can make a great deal, whether you can make a great deal or not, you have to have the genesis of an idea as to how you're going to make money. And you have to evolve your understanding of that transaction to understand where you're going to make money, how you're going to make money, how much of it is there going to be, and who you're going to make it for. An idea in itself doesn't go anywhere. Yeah, it has to be an idea that then ties into a very concise 5-bullet-point plan. If you can't spell it out in 5 bullet points as to how somebody's going to make money out of it, you're going to struggle. And then you have to understand the different components of the industry and how you pull people together to make things happen. Some of that is experience, some of it is network, but a large amount of it is enthusiasm and a willingness to be tenacious and to track people down. And I know this is a great deal, and you might not realize that yet, Rebecca, but by my 10th phone call, you are going to realize this is the opportunity of a lifetime. And if it's a good enough deal, there'll be somebody out there to do it. But if you lose faith in it, it probably won't happen.
So what's a deal that really excited you, a really memorable one, that you would put down as a standout moment in your career?
The first loan-to-own debt deal we did with the guys from DevSec, as was now you and I, where we bought a distressed mortgage in 2009 from Barclays. We had a great team of equity partners, but none of whom understood debt and how it worked. And that, that kind of fits the model I was just explaining to you. We knew if we could buy a shopping centre in Nailsea for £9 million that used to be worth 27, that there was a great value equation there. But we had to put all of the pieces of the jigsaw together to make it happen. And we ended up persuading a real estate investor to buy a piece of debt that they'd never done before. We then bought in the distressed equity in a company and put the whole thing back together again. And over the course of 12 months, put together a deal that has turned into a great deal for, certainly for the buy side of that trade. And there are times you have to persevere and times you think I'm utterly wasting my time, but ultimately the buzz is actually putting the whole things together. And I think most people in our industry, as much as you love the deal and live for the deal, and it's the satisfaction of making things happen.
I think we've milked you long and hard.
My 10-minute chat.
It's been a great chat.
Yes, thank you very much for popping in briefly to see us.
Great. Thanks very much, Morgan Garfield from Alandi, for coming in and having a chat to us today.
Problem.